We all know now who these saints are with their symbols or their attributes. But in fact, I really want to look at this lady on the left-hand side, the woman in scarlet, because this is one of the most popular saints depicted in Western art, Mary Magdalene, sometimes just known as the Magdalene. And she's one of the most fascinating personalities, I think, in the whole of Western art history and, you know, religious history. And she may or may not have existed. She plays a really crucial role in Christ's life. She witnesses the crucifixion. She's present at the burial. She's also there when he is resurrected. And of course, she is depicted here as she almost exclusively is in that red vermilion colour. And we think that the reason that she is known as the Scarlet Woman is because of a biblical source. In Isaiah, it says, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. And in Revelations, there's a reference to the whore of Babylon, who is scarlet and purple while she's riding a seven-headed beast, which might link into the story of the seven demons that were removed from her by Christ. And there's no evidence, in fact, that poor Mary Magdalene was a prostitute, but she has been labelled as such. And red, of course, we associate with prostitution generally, and red-like districts, of course, and so on and so forth. So let's take a look at a couple of depictions of her. This is a very famous painting by Titian, painted around 1514, and it's called Noli Me Tangere, which is Latin for don't touch me or stop touching me. And this is the episode in the Gospel of St. John where Mary Magdalene and Jesus meet shortly after the resurrection. In fact, she's going to anoint his body in the tomb, but she meets him, this man, and mistakes him for the gardener. And she reaches out and he says, don't touch me, for I'm not yet ascended to my Father. Now, why was Mary Magdalene singled out to witness the resurrection? Well, possibly because women were generally seen as gossips in the Middle Ages, and therefore she would definitely spread the word of his return. We think actually she's probably a conflation of several different Marys in the Bible, including the sister of Martha, an unknown prostitute or sinner in the Gospel of St. Luke, and another Mary called Mary of Magdala. But you can see there that lovely sort of Venetian blue in the background of that Titian painting, and I can't help but thinking that he's using the Venetian lagoon there as inspiration. But do notice there again that vermilion or scarlet robe that she's wearing mixed in with white. And now this is very interesting because this is another depiction, quite unusual. This is called The Dead Christ Mourned. Sometimes it's known as The Lamentation of Christ. Sometimes it's known as The Three Marys. And it's by an Italian Baroque painter. And I think you can straight away see that wonderful Baroque dynamic quality. He's called Annibale Carracci, and he was quite an influence on Caravaggio, who was a contemporary of his. And what two things about this, it was actually donated to the National Gallery in 1913 by a female patron. Her name was Rosalind Howard, the Countess of Carlisle. And she was one of the most high profile, actually, aristocratic women in the early 20th century, particularly in the art world. Now, all the different Gospels differ slightly in what happens after the crucifixion, but what we don't normally see, and it's not mentioned in any of the Gospels, is that we have all of these women mourning Christ together. But what you do see here, in fact, is the Virgin Mary, of course, we know, in blue, of course, yes, that lapis lazuli, who, of course, is prostrate with grief on the left. But you generally can always tell Mary Magdalene, apart from the red here, but she's also the most emotional, usually. She usually has the most dramatic expression on her face. But to confuse things further, there are two other Marys in the picture. So there's a close-up of the Virgin Mary. And interesting, she's the only one touching Christ, actually, I think, in the painting. And this is an older woman on the right, who is Mary Cleophas. And the younger lady there on the left is Mary Salome, or Mary Salome. And rather confusingly, they're both sisters of the Virgin Mary. But So lots of areas to deal with there. But I'll just show you that close-up there again of Mary Magdalene. Also, of course, she's also depicted with long hair because long hair was usually, loose hair was only worn in public by prostitutes. So there she is, very dramatically depicted. And finally, I'm slightly obsessed with Mary Magdalene, I think. There, this is a fantastic painting again, National Gallery. This is painted by Giovanni Girolamo Salvoldo, in the early 1500s, so we're going back a little bit now. Didn't paint many paintings, perhaps you've never heard of him, and mostly he does these single figures against a sort of, again, landscape background. And he was painting mostly in Venice, and I do think, you know, that there in the background there, you see to the left, is the Venetian Lagoon. But I think what you notice straight away is that great expression, but also the drapery of the figure. That's what he was mostly known for, particularly showing that wonderful light against the textile. So again, Sunday morning after the crucifixion, Mary Magdalene has visited the tomb of Jesus, but she has found it empty. And she's also identified in this painting, I think we mentioned this with the saint briefly, but just on the left, there's a little vase or a pot, and she's often depicted with a pot of ointment with which she anointed Christ's body. But notice here that she is clad in this sort of white fabric, interestingly, but there's a wonderful glimpse there, look at that, just on her hand, a glimpse of the scarlet underneath that silvery grey cloak. And in fact, there are two other versions of this painting in other galleries, including, I think, the Metropolitan in New York, where she's actually in slightly different coloured robes. But look at this expression on her face. You don't know, do you? What, you know, has she seen Christ? Has she happened upon somebody? There's a sort of wonderful enigmatic quality about it. And you can really see the light there on the shawl. And because he placed the face sort of in shadow, things have changed a bit over time. In fact, you can see the underdrawing just there, can't you? Just above the eyelids. You can really see the sort of lines under her eyes and the lips and the chin. Probably the hair was a little bit more visible originally. But it is, you know, she really is ready for her close-up, isn't she, with the resurrected Christ. It has been suggested also that it might be a Venetian prostitute in the guise of Mary Magdalene. That's also been suggested. But I find that very, something really arresting about the expression on her face. What happened to Mary Magdalene? Well, you all know, of course, she married Jesus, didn't she? And they had children, and the line still exists today. That's what happened, of course, if you've read The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown. Okay, moving on to an extraordinary story here of a definitely a real life woman, Christina of Denmark, the Duchess of Milan. And she's painted here by Hans Holbein, who was the court painter to King Henry VIII, as I think we all now know. And it's very, I've selected this because A, it's the only surviving full length portrait of a woman by Holbein. But it's also a story about a woman who not only saved herself, but she was saved by a woman. And you'll see what I mean as we go. So she's Christina of Denmark. She's the younger daughter of Christian II of Denmark and Isabella of Austria, who was the sister of the Holy Roman Emperor, King Charles V. So that's the family story. She had quite a hard life. The family had fled from Denmark. They'd ended up in Brussels because of religious conflict in Denmark. So she was this sort of grand refugee. And in 1533, she'd been married off at the age of 11 to the Duke of Milan, and he died in 1535. So she was, at this point, the most eligible widow in Europe, and she's 16 years old. And you can see she's dressed there in those rather luxurious, I might say, widow's weeds. Let's take a closer look. She's absolutely gorgeous. She was famous, apparently, for her dimples. Now, despite the close-up, you can't see the dimples because she's not really smiling. But when she smiled, she had these little dimpled cheeks. And also she had a slight lisp when she spoke, which was deemed to be quite cute at the time. But I do love how Holbein's created those lovely rosebud lips. And again, of course, we know how great Holbein was. He was in that Northern Renaissance tradition of painting incredible detail in oil, the fur there just around her robe and the wonderful edging there to her her shift underneath her gown. And she was particularly proud of her hands. She had these lovely, beautiful hands. So she's taken off her gloves and she's holding them, of course, to prove off that, you know, she's not a washerwoman, is she? You know, she hasn't got red hands. She's got beautiful, pale hands that have never seen a day's work in their life. And interestingly, she's wearing that ring with a red stone, which could also be interpreted as a symbol of her mourning. But I do love the elegant fingers. But let's go back to the full length, just so we can appreciate it. So why was it painted? Well, in 1538, it just so happens that in England, King Henry VIII is on the lookout for wife number four, because Jane Seymour has died, giving birth, of course, to the long-awaited son and heir, King Edward, future King Edward VI. And in early March, Hans Holbein, who's 40 years old, is dispatched to Brussels to capture this eligible prospective bride. And we know, because we have the diary accounts, that on the 10th of March 1538, between 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock, in just 3 hours, Christina sat for this portrait, and Holbein probably sketched her all the essentials, the head, the shoulders, the hands, and then probably wrote a few notes about what she was wearing. Comes back, transfers it to a panel. Henry sees it, absolutely thrilled to bits. In fact, he was in better humour than he ever was when he saw it, making musicians play on their instruments all day long. And he specified he wanted a full-length portrait of her because, you know, he needs to make sure that all her limbs are intact and you know, everything else. However, despite negotiations with Brussels, the marriage plans fall through. And it's a living proof, isn't it? You know, no good England negotiating with Brussels. It never works out. But, of course, she also knew of Henry's reputation. And she's supposed to have said, if I had two heads, I would gladly place one at the king's disposal. But it was more to do with the fact, really, that her uncle was the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, and it was up to him if she married Henry, and he said no. So anyway, but he loved the painting so much, he kept it, and he ends up marrying Anne of Cleves, but that's another story, also painted by Holbein, as it happens. I love the fact, by the way, that she's almost moving towards us, don't you think, in the painting. And I love the sort of shadow on the back, and that lovely sort of azurite blue that we talked about last week, which is very characteristic of Holbein's paintings. So anyway, it had several owners. It ended up eventually in the hands of the Dukes of Norfolk, the leading sort of Catholic family. And in 1880, the then Duke of Norfolk loaned it to the National Gallery. In 1908, he decides he wants to sell it and wants to raise money for charity. Now, the problem is we can't really afford to buy it. So it ends up several bids come in, and there's a real danger by 1908 that it's going to be sold to the United States, because there were lots of Americans buying up European art at the time. The Art Fund, the National Art Fund, was set up in order to try and save it. People wrote letters to newspapers, wonderful letters, by the way, about English people saying, why do we need a picture of a foreign duchess when we've got plenty of English duchesses to look at? We don't need another one. Anyway, the price kept going up, and eventually, in April 1909, I think, yes, 1909, Henry Clay Frick of the Frick Collection in New York is this close to successfully bidding for it and getting it. However, at the 11th hour, an anonymous donor stepped in with £40,000, and on the condition that their identity was kept secret, gave the money. And we think, perhaps, we don't know, nobody knows, well, some people know, I don't know, that the person that saved it was a member of the women's suffrage movement, one of the early suffragettes, or suffragists perhaps, who obviously saw this woman as a, you know, a woman who'd had a bit of, you know, very beautiful, very powerful, and made the right decision to not marry Henry VIII. So there we are. Interesting story, isn't it? A woman that saved the portrait. Now we're going to move on to a slightly darker story here. This is